You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network.
August. Sorry, I didn't see you there. Or hear you there. I was laughing a little too hard, and I lost myself. It's only one thing that could mean. August. Did it again. There I go. I better get it together, because we've got a rootin' tootin' hollerin' dootin' episode ahead. You're gonna love it. You're gonna be laughing so hard. Just you wait. Music.
Everybody, welcome to the New World Pictures podcast, where we're going to talk about every movie released by New World Pictures and New World Pictures Inc. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
I've brought everybody an electric can opener.
And Erica.
Damn owls.
And welcome to the end of Ha-Ha-August 3, Rule of Threes. Where we're going to talk about all of the comedy movies released by New World Pictures. And for this episode, we have a very special guest, somebody who's going to be very familiar with the subgenre of this particular comedy. He is the writer, director, producer, and editor of the new movie Dead Media, Joseph Scrimshaw. Welcome to the show.
I am very happy to be here. Very happy.
Awesome. We are so happy to have you. Horror comedy, that is actually one of my absolute favorite subgenres, and I think it is one that is difficult for some people. They like to just have their horror, they like to just have their comedy. I say blend them together, and Dead Media does a great job of doing that. Was that always like the first movie you were going to do, I'm just going to make a horror comedy?
Yeah, so a lot of people see Dead Media and say horror comedy. That was never my intention. What happened for me is I have a long history of comedy. And I wrote the movie thinking about the characters, the themes, the ideas, and the comedy came out of the truth. It's got a weird movie from the 90s that went off the rails, so what would happen in that? And that stuff is funny. There's a man who's stuck in the past in the 90s. That's how he would express himself. That's how he would dress. So for me, it's really different because I came up doing live comedy and doing a lot of playwriting that was comedy. And when you have a live audience and you've told them that comedy is in the title, I feel you owe them a certain amount of laughs. And for me, sitting down to write Dead Media was like, I'm just writing the film I want to write. And I felt no pressure to have any sort of laugh per minute. And I really, really understand how people look at it and go, it's a horror comedy because I've got to see it with lots of audiences and there are a lot of funny parts. But if I had set out to be make a horror comedy, it would be a very different film. There'd be many scenes that are not in it. It would end entirely differently. So for me, this is just like a great, fascinating journey on, you know, reactions, labels, and all like totally understandable to me because there is like a lot of comedy in it.
Yeah. I mean, I think what it does well in terms of horror comedies, the good horror comedies, like they have their moments that are funny and that they mean to be. And then they take a second and go, okay, but now this is the horror part and we're going to deal with that rather than just, you know, always, you can mix them a little bit too, but it has nice moments where it goes, okay, here's the horror part. So we're not going to mess around with that, which I think is a strength of the movie.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, no, I'm really happy with it and happy with how it turned out and excited to see. I keep saying at the screenings, it's a conversation. I'm like, the movie is a statement, and then every audience member gets to have a response, and I hope it's polite. But it's their response, and that's not up to me.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. At some point, you have to give the movie to the audience, as
yes.
they say, right?
So, yes, exactly.
And that's what you're doing right now. You're on tour with this movie, right? So you are touring mm-hmm. around, screening the movie. How is that going?
Yeah, it's going great. Picked up by Antenna Releasing, and if people are just like, hey, we're big fans of distribution companies, Antenna Releasing is a new distribution company that's got a great model, I think, for indie films of trying to not just sort of dump them on streaming. And I think even great movies go to streaming, and they don't make much of an impact after a week. There was a film that came out a couple of years ago that literally everyone I knew was raving about it on social media for a week, and then that was it. And I think it's just kind of the nature of streaming. There's something about it that just kind of wants us to consume, report whether we liked it, and move on. Mm-hmm. And what I love about what Antenna is doing is, you know, we're doing a road show. We've got some merch. We've got a souvenir magazine about Dead Media. We're selling some disc cleaning cloths with a Dead Media logo on it. And we're having a Q&A, and people are meeting each other. And it makes it an event, which I think makes people stop and think about and experience the film more than just like, I should catch this one, but I got to do my laundry, so I'll just kind of half watch it on my phone while I'm doing my laundry, you know. And that, to me, is what's so beautiful about what they're trying to do with these road shows, and it's been going really well. It's so great to talk to people in person, you know, after they see the film and hear their stories about physical media and all that stuff.
And do you watch the film with everyone, or do you like? Are you somebody that's like, okay, I've watched it 1,000 times in the edit, so I'm gonna do the Q&A, I'm gonna step out, I'm gonna come back.
So far, every time, maybe I'll get to a point where I won't, but I am such a student of audience reactions. You know, again, having a long experience with a live performance, you know, a live show, like, you'll really, if you do it a lot, you'll really learn, this line's pretty safe. But the audience will really change on you, you know. If they had a big meal before the show, that entirely changes the show. So I'm like really fascinated with the dynamic of what does a different venue do? What does the, you know, age, you know, range of the audience do? So I feel like I'm less watching the movie again and again, and I'm watching the audience watch the movie.
Mm. Yeah, I always try to do that when you go into anything. Like, you try to be prepared, be a good audience member. Like, I'm ready for whatever this is going to bring, and I'm going to have a good attitude. But we are all guilty of coming in and just being like, I'm tired or whatever, or I just had the worst day. And then just, it's just hard for you to kind of be that good audience member that you need to be on whatever it is you're watching.
I had a big meal right before this podcast, and I can't tell. Is that going to be is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing?
You do that every single week. It's crazy.
That's true.
You
gotta,
He carb loads in advance.
If you get sleepy, it's sure. okay.
This is my marathon every week, so gotta get ready.
You said you had a history in comedy. I know you work with Riff Tracks for a little bit, but did you live performance? Did you do that in Minneapolis?
Yeah, so basically I started out doing some like sketch comedy shows with my brother and some friends, and then really kind of hit the stride doing shows in the Minnesota Fringe Festival and had a number of number one shows. And it was very, very blessed to be a medium-sized fish in a tiny pond at the Fringe Festival. But it was very nice to sort of experience, well, what's it like when people in a specific little kind of silo know you, know your work, are interested in your work. So that was, it was a really good experience, and I really loved it. And I got, it was just so nice. I didn't leave for a while. And then eventually Bill Corbett saw one of my shows and asked me to write a show with him and perform a show with him for the San Francisco Sketch Fest. And that was like 2010. That made me feel like, I love, love, love Minneapolis to death. That's where we shot the film. That's where the film is set. But I wanted to do other things and not just sort of stay in the comfort zone of doing shows at the Fringe and the Bryant Lake Bowl. So I moved on from that. So yeah, so I ended up doing, I've done one-person shows, I've done Shakespeare, I've done children's theater, I've done stand-up, I've done improv, I've done storytelling. Like, I've bounced around a lot, and I eventually was just like, you know what? I want to do one specific thing, and it's going to be film, because I can do lots of other things within film.
Sure, sure, yeah. Sure. My other question. Have you seen Saturday the 14th before this?
No, I hadn't. I remember hearing about it when I was a youngin', but I had not seen it.
Okay, so you We asked, do you watch this movie? And you're like, what is this?
I looked at the runtime when it was proposed. It's like, yep, yeah. I think I can get that in before the podcast.
Okay, good. Well, that's the good thing about New World Pictures movies is that the runtime is always pretty good. But apologies in advance, depending on your reaction, because we are going to talk about 1981's Saturday the 14th.
It gets bad on Friday the 13th, but it gets worse on Saturday the 14th.
The Book of Evil!
Evil? Evil.
Richard Benjamin, Paula Prentiss.
We've inherited a house with a curse.
Oh, come on, Mary. You know you don't believe in curses.
Well, somebody did the dishes, and we're the only ones in this house.
An innocent family driven absolutely batty. Just when you thought it was safe to look at the calendar again, comes Saturday the 14th. The year's number one horror comedy spoof.
God, look at all these owls.
Be sure to see it before sunrise. Saturday the 14th.
That's right, 1981, Saturday the 14th, brought to you by the Erie, Pennsylvania Realtors Association. Looking to buy that home you've been searching for a very long time, look no further than our dedicated realtors. They will work day and, well, day to find you the exact home you're looking for. They'll even drop by, perhaps late at night, just in case the people that own the house you want just might be willing to sell. The Erie, Pennsylvania Realtors Association, we're just dying to get you a new home. This movie was written and directed by Howard R. Cohen in his directorial debut. Cohen had written several movies for Roger Corman. Many, many movies, in fact. Going back to the early 70s with The Young Nurses and Cover Girl Models, which we talked about on this podcast. And he would continue to write and direct movies for Corman well after he sold New World. Along the way, he wrote Deathstalker and Striker and wrote and directed Space Raiders, amongst other films. Cohen was either from or spent time in Chicago, I'm not 100%, and he started a comedy troupe while he was in Chicago with some Second City alumni called the Conception Corporation that would actually release a bunch of records, such as 1972's Conception Land that I listened to partly today.
Nice.
An open letter to the youth of America. Dear youth, I'm writing this letter with a heavy hand. There are great troubles in this glorious land that us old people once died to save. And I feel that today's young need to listen to the raspy voice of today's old. Us old people are the ones who built the toll roads and the condominiums, you know. We invented the electric pencil sharpener and the disposable stove. We're oldies but goodies. After all, who founded this great land but old people? Why, George Washington would be over 200 if he was alive today.
Anyway... one member of the group was Jeff Begun, who had produced Street Girls and Jackson County Jail for New World, and he was part of the troupe, and he brought this concept, actually, and the opening scene to Cohen as a Christmas gift in 1980. As Cohen told the Chicago Daily Herald, he said, quote, Jeff asked if I would like to write the film. I said, on one condition, that I direct it. He said, all right. It was that simple. Movies can be just that simple, everybody. Right, Joseph?
Yep, it's just that easy. You write it down, and then you film it, and then you show it to people, and you're done. It's a three-step process.
So easy. Everyone should do it.
It's so simple. It's so simple. I mean, come on.
I feel downright lazy that I haven't made a movie at this point.
Yeah, get to work, Mark.
It did help that Cohen knew Corman and had worked for him before, so he brought the outline to Corman. He said yes, and he was then also allowed to direct the movie, and he was very excited. But Julie Corman, who ended up producing the film, she said, "I know it's going to go to your head now that Roger's going to let you be a big director. Here's the truth. Directing is very easy for Roger. He thinks anybody can do it. And if he likes you, he'll let you do it."
Now, okay, so is that step 1A? You have to befriend someone who is a movie producer. Yeah. And if they like you, then you're in. You're off to the races. You're off to the next step.
Yeah, it's harder than making the movie.
That's fair.
Yeah, I mean, you had your movie, and then you had to go get distribution, as you're talking about, with Antenna and stuff. So, and you had to get all the financing to make it. So, so this, of course, all seems like, wow, how quaint.
I mean, I don't know a ton about Corman, and I like learning more. I have a pile of books that I haven't read, and like I physically stopped myself from buying a Roger Corman book because I love this factory aspect of it. Like, obviously, you guys are extremely knowledgeable and have lots of opinions about the up and down quality and the impact of his work. But like, after what I went through and what I see other indie filmmakers go through, like, the world needs like 18 million Roger Cormans who set up a factory. And then plug young folks in, and you know, they're not, you know, calling a lawyer and, you know, asking, what is this form I need for investors so I don't get sued? Can I have a party and ask for investment? No, that's illegal. Like, all that stuff that nobody ever talks about in a director's master class, Corman was just taking care of for folks. So I'm just I'm fascinated with that, making a factory of it.
Yeah, he was very willing to give people their first opportunity. And we I was about to say, having done this for 7 years, going on 7 years now, there's up and down results. Sometimes you get people, you know, who just knock it out of the park, and you're like, clearly you're a director. And sometimes you get stuff where you're like, I'm not sure. And this is like, I don't know, maybe somewhere in the middle. I'm not 100%. We'll get into it. Here's where you can watch Saturday the 14th. As of this recording, there's several streaming options, such as Tubi, Prime, Shout TV. You can also track down this Shout Factory Blu-ray that is how we watch this movie. If you want to do physical media, which clearly we are fans of, and so are you, Joseph.
Yes, the film is about a DVD, so yes. Are there good bonus features on that?
Well, there's an interview with Julie Corman, which is nice.
Ooh.
But I didn't realize till late last night that there actually is a commentary, because it does not say it in the back.
And so they hit it.
They don't mention it. They did, which, if you're the people in the commentary, that has to suck.
Oh, man.
So, yes.
Jeffrey Tambor must be pissed. I'm assuming he did the commentary,
yeah,
right?
Of course, it was Jeffrey Tambor. Yeah. Yeah, no problem. He wasn't busy, so that he had no problem doing it. yeah, so I listened to some of the commentary. I would have normally listened to the entire thing, but I literally didn't know it was there. I didn't know it existed.
Yeah.
I had to just find it in the menu.
Amazing.
Menu screen. Big part of your movie. I love that part of it. I love the element of the movie of just going through the menu screen and finding that hidden button that you can find somewhere. I always think that's very cool. There's actually a Canadian company called Gold Ninja Video that I buy a lot of discs from. And he always hides like another movie somewhere on the title screen.
That's awesome.
Which, yeah. So there's always like a secret movie that's on the disc, which I think is an extremely cool thing. So, all right, it's time for us to talk about what this movie is about. Mark, let's start with you. What is Saturday the 14th about?
Short and sweet. Contrary to public opinion, kids shouldn't read books.
Nope. That's what I thought this movie was. I thought this movie was book slander. That's exactly what I put. This is about the big anti-book faction, the big TV trying to tell you stop
big
reading
TV,
books.
Yeah.
Well, stop trying to read picture books. Maybe if it didn't have pictures, he wasn't reading a book like a little baby, he'd be fine.
Erica, what is this movie about?
This movie was about what happens when two people meet each other who are just a perfect match. Mm-hmm. They're just the perfect couple. They're supportive of one another. If something happens, if one of them's in danger, we're going to take care of it. We're going to solve it.
What is that like? I wonder.
I don't know. Beautiful to watch, though. Just absolutely beautiful to watch. Yeah, it was a love story. It was a love story, really.
It was. Joseph, what is Saturday the 14th about?
I think this was a study of the stereotypical man in charge of a nuclear family in the 80s who is so desperate to cling to a sense of normalcy that he refuses to see what is obviously going on with his entire family.
Oh, absolutely.
And wears his shirt for most of the movie.
That's right.
Yeah. So
he runs
shirtless.
Around shirtless yeah. so much.
If he wasn't shirtless enough in Westworld, you know, you can be like, throw on Saturday the 14th. Get your Richard Benjamin fix. Here's what Letterboxd says this movie is about. We are on Letterboxd. Joseph, you are on Letterboxd as Dead Media is on Letterboxd.
Yes.
But are you there? Have you been on that on the platform?
I am there twice, which happens to many folks. Of like, I signed up, and then you know, before I could get to it, somebody signed me up as the director of my film. So then there are two me's that I need to jump through some hoops to make one.
Oh, I see. I see. And I thought initially you were saying I've been on the site twice, which is typical of our guests. A lot of our guests are not on Letterboxd and take the opportunity of guesting on our show to sign up for Letterboxd.
Nice.
So, but I'm glad that, yeah, that you're familiar. Anyway, here's the synopsis that they have given us. After his family moves to a new house, a young boy discovers a mysterious book that details a curse hanging over the date of Saturday the 14th. Half that sentence I feel like was good, and then it started to go...
Yeah. It loses me on details.
We're stretching. But yeah, details, no details.
We'll also be picking apart that sentence in the SemanticCast next week.
Just, thank you.
It's poor prose.
Thank you.
It's our poor prose month that we're doing.
Something the SemanticCast hates so much.
Poor prose month is wild. People get nuts.
Did you guys pick up your poor prose t-shirts yet? Have you grabbed them? With the big
all
cross,
new ones, they're the new, the new the season cross. Poor Pro shirts are in calligraphy, everyone, so they'll be out soon.
Impossible to read, but beautiful.
Also the name of Mark's side project goth band. P.O., you are pros, okay? The thinker. It's a think piece.
You gotta really think it out. Spelling counts, guys. Opening the book releases a band of monsters into the house, and the family must join together to save themselves and their neighborhood. Again, first part of that sentence, I'm like, yes? The second half of this sentence, nope. No, that's not what this movie is. No. It's too silly. They're not, it's hard to describe the movie as being silly, which of course is the kind of comedies that Roger Corman loved. Silly comedies, that's what he always loved. Mm-hmm. In 1981, they also released The Private Eyes, which is with Tim Conway.
Don Knotts, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He loves silly comedies. This is the 1981 New World Pictures guy.
Wow. He just glovelessly handled that. Well, how's that for poor prose? How's the prose on that? Right. Glovelessly? That's got to be a word.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It belongs in a museum. But this movie is silly. It starts with vampires. Vampires, played by Nancy Lee Andrews. She was a model who had been engaged to Ringo Starr until 1980, and she was making her acting debut here, and she only acts in a few other things, goes on to become a photographer. But she's teamed with Jeffrey Tambor in only his second film role ever, and a ways away from The Larry Sanders Show and Arrested Development. Mm-hmm. These vampires are different, though. They are into real estate, number one. Mm-hmm. And they meet with their realtor during the day, so that's new.
The day thing is new, but I would argue that vampires have always been very real estate obsessed.
Yeah, yes. Given that's a great point.
That's Dracula's whole thing. He just wants to move to the UK.
That's true.
If
that's
anything, like having like somebody who's like half human, you know, that can like be their caretaker, a lot of their job is probably real estate.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably most of it.
So where am I going to sleep tonight? Where am I going to sleep tonight?
Yeah, exactly.
Are we convenient to the school here?
Oh, yes, the school is just two blocks away.
And young children will walk past here regularly.
Do you two have children?
As often as we can.
Waldemar?
Solid joke.
Mm-hmm. Ask no more questions. We're supposed to be typical people looking for a home.
I am looking for a way into this house. You ask normal questions.
Tell me, what does the building code say about filling the basement with earth? Well, it is a finished basement.
Not yet, it isn't.
That line made me laugh so hard. That's how little dork I am. He's like, ask a normal question. She's like, what is the building code? I was like, oh, just kill me.
Yeah, that's normal people that killed for me. You.
That's how normal people talk.
Sadly, the vampires won't be getting the house. The house is going to a family that inherited it, specifically John and Mary Hyatt, played by Richard Benjamin, and Paula Prentice, a real-life couple.
What?
They were married. They married, like, they met in college. And they got married in the 1960s. They had been on a 1960s TV show, a TV sitcom called He and She, which only lasted one season, but it earned Prentice an Emmy nomination. Wow. And right around this time, Benjamin would actually start his own directing career and became more of a director in the 80s and 90s, starting with 1982's My Favorite Year. So...
Oh my God, that's adorable.
I know.
That's
I know.
Adorable. No wonder he had his shirt off all the time. She's probably loving it. She's probably like, get your shirt off, Dick. Come on. See the goods. Like,
shirt off again? Jeez, come on.
Yeah.
What are you trying to, who are you trying to impress? Come on now.
Seriously. And they do shoot at a real house. This was a house that Julie Corman had found and I think had used in another movie. I couldn't figure out which one it was, but it's at 1190 West Adams Boulevard in Los Angeles, California.
Oh my God, we should have recorded there.
No doubt.
Met there and recorded out front.
I'm sure the owners would have loved that.
Yeah, they would have loved it. Would have loved it. Here's what Doug Carlton of Keep Old Los Angeles told Fantastic Films in 1982 about the location. He said, quote, Julie wanted to shoot in the old Wilcox Mansion in the downtown Los Angeles area. Julie had previously shot another feature there and knew with a little bit of extra cobwebbing, its beautiful woodwork, leaded glass windows, hammered tin roof, and aura that surrounds a house built in 1889 would definitely benefit the dilapidated old mansion described in Cohen's script. Mm. Now, Joseph, you shot your movie in a house.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A house that was very near and dear to your heart, right?
Yes, yes. It's the house my father lives in, and I moved into that house when I was 13 and then moved out in my early 20s. So, yes, that spent a lot of time in that house. It was a very fun and interesting experience to sort of rewrite my own childhood by doing something really different in the house.
That's cool.
So your dad was still living there while you were shooting it the entire time?
Yeah, I tried to get him a hotel, and he's like, I'm going to save you this money. I'm just going to go, like, find a place to sit and drink coffee and read a book. My dad's very precise, and I kept trying to tell him. It was like, he kept asking, like, well, when do you stop shooting? He's like, well, we stopped shooting at, 8:30, but people will still be lingering around and packing up, and he just couldn't hear it. So the first day he came home right at 8:30, and our practical effects and monster makeup guy was in the kitchen, and he's a very tall man, and understandably, like, somebody else opens the door who's not in the crew, and he said, "Hey, who are you? What are you doing?" And my dad told me later, he's like, "Some tall man asked me who I was in my own kitchen." Like, but that was about the worst thing that happened. He was great with everything.
That's good, because you use the house for a lot of the movie, much like this, it's mostly in the house.
I mean, yeah, it's mostly two locations. Yeah.
So how long did you shoot the movie for?
14 days total. So we did 7 days at the theater location and then 7 days at the house. So it was a very, very fast shoot. Yeah, I read the Wikipedia of this, of Saturday the 14th, and I think it said 3-week shoot, and I was jealous.
Yes, three weeks, which is... Yeah. Kind of average, but I would say even kind of long for a new world.
It's a little luxurious for a New World Pictures movie.
It's a little bit longer than New World would usually have. But this is 1981, so in the 70s, I would say you're going to get like a 14-day shoot, probably, like you just had. Maybe 15, 16, but you're not going to get a ton. But that's like more of an average. But the house is cursed in this. And I think that's real estate law. You have to tell somebody if they're going to buy a cursed house. I think I have that right. I haven't bought a cursed house. But I don't know. Fingers crossed. You never know. Down the road. Then they do
I think that's limited to you have to tell people if someone died in the house. I'm pretty sure Cursed is not. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you can get away with vibes.
Yeah. vibes are not in the contract.
They're hard to legally enforce.
I do not have to disclose the vibe.
Yeah, I feel like Gen Z is going to change that about real estate law. Yeah, vibes are very important to Gen Z. They're gonna set that right.
All the vibes are pretty miserable. Also, someone died in the house. I really don't care that someone died. I just want to know if the vibes are going to be okay. I've brought Sage with me.
Vibes are off. No deal. Next house. Next house. Yeah. Let's go. Vibes are off.
They learn a little bit more, though, about why the things are cursed. Or maybe not why things are cursed, but they learn more about the house because they get this note from his deceased uncle.
Don't open the book.
Don't open the book. Of course, Billy, their son, already found the book, and he is reading it, of course. Darn your inquisitive mind, Billy. Billy is played by Kevin Brando. You heard that right. Brando, meaning his father is Hub Brando, leader of the 60s band The Dreamers. So young Brando, though, the one playing Billy, not his dad, the leader of the 60s band The Dreamers, the Brando that we all know, would go on to voice Schroeder in the Peanuts cartoons in the 1980s. So that's what he did. Here, though, Billy is looking at monsters and unleashing the monsters. One of them, of course, we get into is attacks his sister in the bathtub. We get a little bit of a Jaws fake out where it's sort of more of a creature of the Black Lagoon. This is his sister Debbie, played by Give Me a Break actress Carrie Michelson. I couldn't confirm this, but IMDb trivia being what it is, I couldn't confirm this or figure out if it's false, but it sounds so true. And that is that Corman apparently wanted her to be naked in the bathtub scene, but she refused. Now, she's maybe 20, I think, at the time they shoot the movie, maybe 19, 20.
But she's like playing a child. Mm-hmm. And also her character is a child, so it's like,
yeah, she's supposed to be playing a high schooler, so it sounds, though, so much like Corman that I'm like, I don't know where they got that story, but kind of sounds true. I don't know if it is, but it sounds very true, because he certainly, they even said that he thought about getting a body double, which he did all the time. When people would say, no, I don't want to do that, he would say, no problem, we'll just get a body double.
I should get a body double for this podcast.
No doubt.
I'll show you guys. I'll be like, you know what? Mm-hmm. I'm going to body double it. Mm-hmm. Do they do my voice too? How does that work? I'll look into it.
I think it's just body from what you're saying.
Yeah, just body. It's not a voice double.
Yes.
Do I have to move their lips? Like Weekend at Bernie's style? Do I have to
You're not asking for a body double. You're asking for a life-size puppet is what you're That's what you're describing.
Yeah, I'm not sure what part of you don't want to show in the way you're describing this.
You want someone else to do the podcast for you, but apparently you're still puppeting them and having them say what you want.
Which seems like more work than just being on the podcast.
You should just do the podcast. Just do the podcast. You'll be fine.
Okay, guys. I'm recommitted.
The thing about the creature, the Black Lagoon creature, that I wanted to point out was that he chases Debbie down the stairs, and then I think he's chasing at this point their neighbor, who's a cop, comes in and starts shooting him. And he chases them, and he has his arms out, and then he looks down because there's like two steps to go down to the absolute. So he looks down to go down the steps. Did anyone else notice that?
Yeah, it made that me cracked laugh me so up. Much. I was like, oh, he's so safe. And his feet are probably wet, so he just wants to make sure he firmly gets down those steps.
Clearly can't see down here.
Yeah.
But also, Ryan, hold on. A creature is still going to want to be safe. A creature can still roll its ankle. You know, they're going to be true. Like, listen, I don't want to slip. I don't need to get hurt.
Yeah, I don't know the age of the creature. It could have been a creature in his 40s and, fall risk.
Right.
And had just recently had an injury and was like, I can't re-injure this.
Correct.
Knee
See, you
again.
Saw how slowly and carefully he stood up from the tub. He was being real safe.
Real safe. He's inside a tub. Clearly, tubs have hurt him in the past.
Yeah.
Also, I think that there's a real opportunity out there to make a movie where it's haunted by domestically inclined ghosts. Like, they're not really trying to hurt or haunt you. They just want to clean. Like, I think
the best kind of ghost, really. The best, I mean, if you can
the
get
kind
them.
Of ghost I would like. That'd be a ghost plus good vibes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I would report that.
Please haunt.
Haunt away.
Though, if they get upset with the kind of messes you make to the point where they're like, again, you can't bring this cup to the kitchen. You can't. Like, yeah. And then you're like, oh, yeah, this ghost thing's not as much fun as I thought it would be.
I put a dish in the sink and the ghost is right behind me going, oh, so close to that dishwasher.
You're so close. So close.
Dishwasher's right there.
If only you just took another tiny, not even a step, just a move. A movement.
Just a little movement of your torso. You could have done it.
Yeah, I'm going to get away from these ghosts now. This went south for me.
I guess it really just depends on what kind of house cleaning ghosts you get.
Yeah.
But Mary discovers not ghosts, but bats up in the attic, and we find that Jeffrey Tambor is there, and I guess he's the one that bit her. This is kind of how this kind of comes out. She gets bit at one point in the movie, but we never see that.
Mm-hmm.
To get rid of the bats, John calls an exterminator. We get our Van Helsing, which is a nice little twist they have in this movie, and he arrives at their house.
So, you're the man with bats in his belfry, eh?
You're the exterminator?
Yeah.
You don't look like an exterminator.
That's to fool the bats. What have we here? Nothing fires the imagination so much as a fine library. Do you have any old books? Any very old books?
Maybe you better ask Billy. He's the smart one in the family.
No, no, no old books. I always throw my old books away when I'm finished reading them.
Old books can be worth quite a lot of money. Take this to my room.
Your room?
Yes, Van Helsing. He's played by Second City veteran and Jackson County Jail actor, Severn Darden. Mm. And you can tell Howard Cohen is very taken with getting him in this movie. He'd been in Chicago. He was very, obviously very fond of Severn Darden. And you can tell this, even Julie Corman, of course, she mentions in an interview with the Frida Cinema. She said that, quote, it was a feather in Howard's cap to get Severn to be in his movie. And you can tell because he's in the movie maybe too much.
He does take over when he gets there.
As soon as he gets there, we kind of don't get a lot of the family. It's weird, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He takes over, but that scene, I'm so glad you clipped that scene, I thought was so funny. And now just listening to it without the visuals, like, it's such a great scene that I think it even works even if you can't see it, because him going like, do you have any old books? And the little boy being like, oh, I throw my books away when I'm done with them, cracked me up when I first heard it.
Yeah.
But then when I completely didn't see it coming when he's like, and you see him come in with this bag with the suitcase and it's got all the stickers on it. But then when he's like, here, take this to my room, I lost it. I was like, what a great, like, he's just supposed to be there as the exterminator and he's going to move in temporarily.
Outside of saying you're staying, he's like, and he makes a comment of like, it takes time to get rid of the bats or however he says it. The dad's immediately just apoplectic and, all right, sure, take him to the guest room. Like, yeah. I would be like, but you could still go home, right? He also never
tries to get rid of the bats, right?
Right.
He doesn't do that. He just moves in, he has breakfast, he doesn't do anything. He's
tells them what trying. They should be buying for the party. Like,
yeah.
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 It does kind of create an imbalance. And I wanted to ask Joseph, when you're writing a script or even putting the script together, do you have like a sense of that, of how to like balance the characters out a little bit and try not to, maybe you have a great line that you have to kind of cut because you're like, well, we're taking away from, you know, our main characters.
Yeah. No, I slaughtered many darlings in the process of Dead Media, and I think it's always just a trying to reconnect to what is the priority, like either the character or the theme, and are we, you know, jangling some keys that are really fun but make people turn away from the primary character's needs or the primary theme, and I think he is a little bit of a jangly key. Like in some ways, he's like, great, okay, someone's going to put his foot on the gas of the actual, like, plot of, like, resolve the situation. So, like, yes, thank you, Van Helsing. But then he seems like he's going to do that. But then, yes, he does just sort of, he changes doesn't. His mind about what he's going to do three or four times. He repeats himself often. We totally lose track of the family. And I think the wife is being at her absolute funniest with the just a great performance of the very loud, angry voice into the peaceful voice. And so I was more into that than old Van Helsing.
Darling, have a little peace.
No! Thank you very much.
Sweetheart, have a taste. You'll love it. Debbie used a lot of garlic.
No garlic! Keep it away! Thank you very much.
She is becoming that vampire, and she was supposed to actually wear fangs, Paula Prentice, in becoming the vampire. In fact, Julie Corman, in her interview with the Frida, said that Paula Prentice, quote, didn't want to wear fangs. I thought, how can I tell Howard that Paula says she's not wearing these fangs? And she says, Dick assured me, trust me, you will believe she's a vampire. He was right. But apparently does not like to wear fangs and refused to do so. But I think she does kind of make it work.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think
bastard.
She needed fangs.
She should have worn the fangs. She should have put them on. What could go wrong? Just put the fangs on.
Did anyone not want to do any of the creature stuff in your movie?
No, everybody was very excited for it.
Oh, even though they're like got lots of makeup and blood and all that stuff.
There was a comment from one actor about I can't get it out of my ears when I go home, so might as well just do it again. Let's just go.
Maggie is a troubled young woman who just wants to watch an old horror movie on streaming. Her aging Gen X uncle gets word of this and says, no, you gotta watch it the best way, on old school DVD. But the disc ain't right, and horror ensues. That is the story of Dead Media, the world's first haunted DVD movie, and it is coming to cities across the U.S. this summer and fall. For tickets and full details, check out antennareleasing.com/film/deadmedia, because some folks may be done with the DVD, but it's not done with you.
Ah, yes, Ryan, it's time. Mark, Joseph, who wouldn't want to talk about things we loved and things we hated?
That's right, we're going to talk about the things we love, the things we hated about Saturday the 14th. Mark, what did you love?
Spoiler alert, if you're listening to this and you're about to watch it and you don't want any spoilers, now's the time to maybe fast forward for the next 30 seconds.
It's a little late, but I hear you.
But the final battle of sound effects was hilarious.
Yeah.
That was my favorite scene.
So long. So we go through the whole, like, funny, okay, can we get over this, to, yep, it's funny again. Because it felt like 10 minutes, and quite honestly, it could have gone 5 minutes more, and I would have been still into
it. It's really, really dumb. It's a really great bit. It's really funny. Erica, what is something you loved?
I loved some of the visual gags, too, having that rat puppet kind of come in and steal things and just be waiting in the fridge. And when it was early on, when the family first moves in the house, and the mom, wife, character is in the kitchen cleaning, and everything's a mess still. There's cobwebs and dust. And she pulls that skull out of the cabinet and cleans it off and puts it back in. And then, like, smoke or something or dust blows out, and she just picks it out and just doesn't investigate, just wipes it off again and puts it back in. I don't know. Just cracked me up. Mm-hmm. Yep. And every time they'd talk about her, they'd be like, where's mom? And they'd be like, cleaning, of course. it was so random. Loved it.
Joseph, what's something you loved?
I liked some of the jokes that suddenly became a little bit darker. In college, I read Sigmund Freud's book on humor, and he divided it into innocent jokes versus the phrase he uses, tendentious jokes. But basically, like, jokes that are silly and like have a cultural meaning, like the scream off of, like, this is just kind of a riff on sound effects, but it's not saying anything particularly, like, you know, about our state as humans or whatever. And that's most of the movie. It's silly fun, right? And and visual gags and all that. And every once in a while, there'd be a line that's like, oh, that's a little bit darker. That's a little bit like, there was the, Van Helsing has the line of like, that's closing the barn door after the horse has eaten your children. Which is like much nastier than a lot of the film. And when Van Helsing is trying to warn of what will happen if the baddies get the book, he's a famine, war, death, and the father says, those we've got. Which is like, it's like funny banter, but it's also like much darker about like, oh, so the world's not going to be that much worse if the bad guys get the book, because we're already in hell. Great. It felt very 81. It felt very like Reagan nuclear war kind of joke hiding in this mostly fun comedy.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I think there is a bunch of little funny things in here that I loved. I mean, first of all, as we've already mentioned, I love the two leads. I love Richard Benjamin and Paul Prentice, but there's so many little bits that I just really liked. There's some bits that don't work for sure, but there's a couple I really liked. I loved when they all the family gets out of the car and they look at the house, but they're looking at the house like across the street or next door or whatever, and they're like, "What a beautiful house!" It's the wrong house. I love the fact that any loud noise is owls. Like,
yes,
they think the bats are owls, but then like the creature like falls out of the bedroom and like onto the ground, and he's like, "Owls." I love it. Just like any noise. Those electric can openers. Oh my God. I do remember how popular those things were and how everybody was like running to grab those. It was like, oh my God, you can set the can and it just turns and it opens itself. And everyone was like, this is incredible. This is technology that will endure. This is we're done with opening the can and twisting it. That will never come back. This is the thing.
We're all free.
Finally,
what a time saver.
Yep.
This can opening prison we used to live in. We're finally past it.
I'm aging myself, but I remember when we got one. I was like, whew.
Yeah.
Ooh.
It was like
Harvest Gold, and it had like chrome. Like you push the chrome handle down, and it was like wham. And I'm like,
oh, that sounds gorgeous.
Ooh.
Yeah. Just sure it matched the kitchen and everything. Looked great.
It did. That's it why. Didn't stand out. Yeah, it matched That's the right. phone That's and right. the oven. Yeah, it was all that that color.
There's some great little bits in here. Things we hated. Let's switch to that. Mark, what's something you hated?
I hated that the music in this movie sounds like it was recorded as an exquisite corpse, where you had a bunch of different people recording what they thought the soundtrack should be, and then they just decided to cut it all together. I have a little clip for listeners who are uninitiated.
Ooh, came with a clip. Came clipped.
I could have pulled this from anywhere in the movie, but this was one that just struck me. I'll just play it. Wait, I cut that down from 30 seconds of going, what is happening? Nobody is on the same page. It's multiple different instruments playing different melodies, and they just kind of cut it all together. And in a way, I love it, but I also kind of hate it.
Yeah.
Did you start noticing it? Did it take you out of the rest of the film because you were feeling cursed by the randomness?
Yeah, there were legitimately there were scenes like the one that I took this from where I wasn't even paying attention to the scene anymore because I'm going, "What is happening? You have a stand up bass." Then you have a piano, you have an organ, you have a synthesizer, and none of them are playing the same melody at all. What is happening with this music?
Yeah, it feels like it was all just sort of clipped together. I can't remember if there was a composer in the credits. Or is that standard for Corman to just be like, we will chop up the library and make a score?
Well, what's most common for Corman is when he got a good score, like the score that he had for Battle Beyond the Stars, he repurposed that for multiple movies.
Nice.
So this is a little unusual because he normally did have a score for each movie, even if it was repurposed. But this, like I said, it was like an exquisite corpse where everyone was told, just write something and we'll just cut it all together.
Yeah.
Erica, what did you hate?
There wasn't much that I hated. I was really delighted by this. I found it really silly and refreshing. I think what I hate the most is thinking about what's coming next. So
sure.
I think that that's what I hate. When I look back, I just think, oh, geez, that was really fun and silly. Oh, no. I'm scared.
Joseph, what did you hate?
The pacing in parts. There were parts where, like, it was very funny and it was really trucking and we were spending time with a specific character, and then it would slow down a bit. And yeah, I think that's the biggest thing.
Yeah, I do agree with that. It had had a kind of Corman-esque pacing to it a bit, where, like, it seems semi-chopped up, like he's dumping certain things and he's cutting the ends of each scene, which he would do a lot. Everything to trim things down to below 90 minutes, which is a big rule for him.
Did you guys notice, too, like, when you're saying that, Ryan, I noticed, like, several times there are, like, really hard cuts that I was like, feels like something was missed there. Like, was that intentional or was that an accident?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know for sure, but the Blu-ray does not have deleted scenes. It does have a commentary that was deleted from the back information.
Did it have bloops?
It doesn't have bloopers either, no.
I think those are in the movie, mostly.
Yeah, they kept those in.
Kept them in.
They were like, no, keep all the bloopers.
I'll also say I disliked that there wasn't more Yolanda. I thought I didn't know she was an inexperienced actor, and I actually thought she was very funny and that line at the beginning that you had in the clip was great, and
she's really good. She's very good in the movie too. It's unfortunate she didn't do more after that, but after this, for me, I didn't like that there is no rules to this. It would have been very simple to create rules. The book. You open it, the monsters come out, but what does the book do? Does it take them out or doesn't it? It sort of does and doesn't. He attacks a monster and the book just pushes the monster out the window, but it doesn't, like, and then some creatures, they're absorbed by the book. Like, it didn't have rules that made any sense. I was like, this would have been a very easy thing, that the book is all powerful and can get rid of these monsters, and it still would have played into these vampires don't want them to have the book. Because they want to be the only... I don't know, but there was no rules to it. And I wanted to ask you, Joseph, because you created your own creatures for Dead Media. Mm-hmm. And did you spend a long time trying to think of the rules? Because I do feel like there were rules that were specific to these characters, and you had to, like, kind of set the table for that, for the audience.
Yeah, I really like... I like the idea of rules. I think there's, like, this great tension with the idea of rules that... It has long been established in horror that, like, we want to visit the supernatural and the unknown and the mysterious, but then there's this other side of us that craves rules. And, you know, way back in, like, 1931 Dracula, Van Helsing, that one comes in. He's got the vampire rules, and you know them, and you trust them. But then I think it's interesting to me when you have rules, but you have to kind of question who are you getting them from. Van Helsing is usually a reliable narrator. He isn't in this film. So I really like being able to play with rules of, like, how much do we cling to them so that our scary, unknowable monsters are a little bit knowable and we can control them because we can understand how to defeat them, and we can shake our finger at the screen if the rules get broken, versus... I think it's really interesting to me and what I wanted to play with in the film of, like, well, who tells us the rules and do we believe them and are they accurate?
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that was what, like, back in the day with, like, when Blair Witch came out, I think that was the number one thing of just, like, horror movies had become so attached to rules, and Scream had pointed it out really well. And that was what was scary about it. It was like, yeah, she's an old witch in the woods, and you don't know why she puts you in the corner, and you can't see her face, and you didn't find a book, and there isn't an old man in the woods with the answers that you found, and just no rules, sorry. And I that really affected me in 99. I was like, oh, wow, sometimes no rules is great.
You can go too far, for sure, like the other direction.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this whole film is, like, really walking on that edge of just, I wanted to have silly fun. Versus the characters are likable enough, and the relationships and the stakes are set kind of clearly. So it just there's a little bit of a push and pull, I think, of, like, okay, I like that it's a kid forward movie where, like, the kid is the only one who understands what's going on. Like, the mom's got her own vampire problems.
Yeah, right.
The dad is oblivious. The daughter, yep. Poor Debbie, is not given a lot to do other than be almost naked.
And scream a lot.
So the kid becomes really this focus of he's the one, you know, that great classic, like, if this is a movie for kids, the kid wants to be the smart one and knows what's going on. And I was kind of invested in the kid and wanted him to, like, figure out the rules and know the answers. But the movie was kind of like, sometimes rules, sometimes not.
Yeah, it almost could have had this more kid-ventury kind of track where he's kind of trying to figure out getting the book. How do I get these monsters back in the book? And we sort of just, that all just disappears because once we get Van Helsing, it's all like him and the bits about him. Mm-hmm. And you think he's going to solve it. And it still would have been kind of cool to have a little bit more of that in there. I mean, that's clearly not the direction they went in. And they just were like, who's going to care? We're just, it's a silly movie. But here we are. Here we are discussing it.
It's funny that you say that too, Ryan, because Kid Venture is the opening track on Poor Prose's first album. You should check it out. Kid Venture is such a good song. You'll love
it. It's really dark. It's really
so dark.
It's so dark. Yeah. Which is funny considering the title, but very dark. Let's talk about our favorite scene. Mark, what was your favorite scene?
Well, I realized that the thing that I loved was also a favorite scene, but I mean, it's kind of, but it was something I really loved. But my favorite scene was the small moment that, so the neighbor comes over and brings over an electric can opener, and then she's being attacked. And as she's falling down, she sees her dead husband's head on the table. And she's like, Ernie, oh, thank God you're here. And then goes so far as to say, why aren't you doing anything about this? Not putting together the fact that it's just the head. I thought that was hilarious. I thought that was really well done. It's a tiny second of a scene, but thought it was really funny.
Yeah, I agree with that one. That was really good.
Erica, what was your favorite scene?
I kind of mentioned it earlier, but when Van Helsing first arrives and does the bit about where is the old book and show me to my room. My second favorite scene, if I may, maybe so bold to have two favorite scenes.
Sure.
Was when all the monsters are kind of pigging out in the kitchen and just like eating everything in the dark. Just like, how do I leave the kitchen?
This isn't the bathroom. This is the kitchen. What am I doing in the kitchen? What are they doing in the kitchen? How am I going to get out of the kitchen?
Just thought, again, it was like fun and silly, and you got to see all the monsters all at once. And it's just, just fun. That was my second favorite.
Joseph, your favorite scene?
It's kind of a running gag, but there are two specific scenes. I love that they could only get Twilight Zone. That was just like such a great twist on the haunted house and, you know, the era of burgeoning cable in 81. So I like the initial scene where they're trying to change the channel. And I like the scene. It's one of the best moments for the daughter, which is like, there's nothing but Twilight Zone. And like, well, that's just how broadcast goes. Like, I saw I Love Lucy. I watched nothing but I Love Lucy for 6 hours. I love that Twilight Zone runner.
That was really great.
Good. Let's go to final questions. Here are final questions for Saturday the 14th. Did you guys notice what famous actor's father played the lawyer in one of the early scenes?
Marlon Brando.
That would have been perfect. Boy, that would have been perfect, wouldn't it?
Erica should be the one answering this question.
100%. 100%.
I should? I don't know.
It's Stacy Keach Sr. Got another Keach.
Another Keach?
We got another Keach.
I love how many layers there are to the Keach family that I'm completely oblivious to and unaware of.
You're learning
of.
So much about the Keaches as
there's
we go through this podcast.
Another Keach? Fantastic. Yep. What great news. Lucky me. Thank you, August.
Speaking of guest stars, there's another one. Did you notice The Big Dollhouse and Women in Cages is Roberta Collins?
No.
She's one of the family members. She plays Cousin Rhonda. who's like stealing things and putting stuff in her bag.
Yeah.
And she's nearly killed by a monster when she's looking for Billy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't even realize that was Roberta Collins
the first time
through. And the second time I was like, saw her name in the credits. I was like, where is Roberta Collins in this? Who was in a bunch of movies for New World and for Corman. She did tons of work.
Oh, I didn't notice that either.
Yeah.
Cool. Oh.
Very cool.
Speaking of that scene when she gets attacked, what was that monster attacking her? All of a sudden, we had these new monsters at the end. What was that?
Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, they sold the Book of Evil pretty hard that there's just absolute demons from hell. It's mostly just like kind of friendly monsters with a little bit of a pot belly waddling around.
Adorable. Yep.
Two little weird eyes coming up and just being like, yep.
It's just me.
I think this is a good question to end on. Why is physical media so great and important to our lives?
Do you want my opinion?
yeah, you bet.
All right.
Anybody's.
for God's sakes. I think that there's a real power in things we love becoming tangible. You've been going on podcasts and talking about the movie that's, you know, about a haunted DVD, so I got a lot of time to think about this. And, you know, as a kid, I loved Star Wars, and I couldn't see it again. It was not in theaters. It wasn't out on VHS yet. So it existed in the storybooks, in the action figures, and all of these things in the physical world that wasn't this sort of ephemeral, ethereal thing that is a film. And I think that, especially now we're in this streaming era, where it's really hard to just like literally hold in our hands the things that we love, that physical media has become even more important because it can make something we love tangible in the real world. Because it's in the real world, it can drive community. You can go to a store to buy it, even if you buy it online. We're not even in the same place, and I'm like scanning your bookshelf because it's telling me about your DVD shelf, because it's telling me about who you are and what you choose to collect and what you choose to own. Is like this little museum of you and your tastes. Mm-hmm. And maybe we could get that if you took a screenshot of your to-watch list on streaming. But it's not the same. It's not tangible and real. And I think we're just in a time where we need balance in our lives. So much of our life has become digital, and we really need the tangible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Could not agree more.
Thank that.
Could not agree more. Erica, see? See? See, these are valuable.
I would only extend that to say
I often look at Tin Drum and think, "Ooh, thank goodness that you're here!" And I just put it to my face and I smell it and I'm like, "Ooh, I love you."
I would only extend that to say the same to me very much applies to vinyl records.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And much like in movies when I was a kid and I would the artwork of a movie poster, I would just stare at and think, what is happening in that movie? Movies I hadn't seen yet. Movies I couldn't see because maybe I was too young to see it. And I remember going to the video store and just loving to just look through the boxes and pick them up and look at the back and read about it and who directed this, who edited this, who was behind this movie. Mm-hmm. In the same way, vinyl, being able to, you know, read the lyrics and see all the people involved, all the pictures that were on the insert that you know, at CDs you would get that, but cassettes you didn't often get the same thing. And certainly digital took that all away. And it felt like part of owning a record, a big part of it, of course, the music is the biggest part, but a big part of it was the physical, like looking at it and reading about it. And Spotify does not scratch that itch at all.
In the mid 90s, I became like a sincere Sinatra fan and that whole era of music. And at that point, some of the music was out on CD, but not a lot. So I was like, okay, well, I go from Sinatra to Sammy Davis Jr. And if I want to hear the Sammy Davis Jr. record, like, I know it exists because there's a picture on another sleeve. And then, so I have to go find it. And that hunt was really rewarding. But then I discovered, like, in the later era when Sinatra owned his own label, the Reprise label, they hired this just wild dude named Stan Kornin, who wrote the liner notes or the back of the album for almost everybody. And just like out of control, bonker. Like your podcast that yelling at people about how they use language, he would be a very big target of that podcast, because just like string, he's gonna swingily bop through a bunch of standard woo-ha, and like, what are you talking, like, it's like trying to be cool. And like, so I became a fan of like, it's like, it's, at that point it was 40-50 years, and like that guy was long gone dead, and he's like, mm-hmm. he's, you know, a footnote in The Legend of Sinatra, the guy who in the mid to late 60s wrote his the back of his album text. But I knew that because of The Real Thing, you know?
Yeah, right.
You need nothing like that on Spotify.
Nope.
Let's get into some research here real quick. Here's our research for Saturday the 14th. Last month, we spoke to Ernest Farino, who worked on so many movies. He was a director and also a special effects artist. And he worked on this movie, and you can listen to our interview where he does talk about creating and turning Jeffrey Tambor into a bat. But I asked him about this movie because there's other effects in here that he did, which we did not discuss. And he wrote me back, and here's what he said. He said, yes, I did all of the roto animation effects throughout the film, such as when the kid fends off a monster with the book, causing sparks to fly. Also, after the family has moved in, there's a breakfast scene, and after they leave, a monster looks in the window and zaps a vase of flowers on the kitchen table. I animated the flowers wilting. We reconstructed the set on the stage at the Lumberyard, which was Corman's studio in Venice, California, that was literally a lumberyard that he turned into a movie studio. Remarkably, found exact matches to the tablecloth, drinking glasses, etc. The stems and petals of the flowers are made of pliable aluminum that could be animated stop motion. That was the very last shot I did on the project. So just wanted to share that. We got to talk to somebody who worked on the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Quick, let me just say, my favorite scene was when those flowers died.
Right.
That was my favorite scene. That had to be so complicated.
Well, it looks awesome. Boy, do I have a story for you. Now, we talk about movies from New World Pictures being exploitation movies, and they are. But this is an exploitation of what? Of this burgeoning horror spoof that was happening in the early 80s after Halloween and then Friday the 13th and everything else. Of course, if you're renting this movie or watching this movie thinking Saturday the 14th, I know what this is going to be about, well, you'd be wrong a little bit. But there were other movies that were doing exactly what you would think a movie called Saturday the 14th was doing. In fact, director Alfred Soule, who directed the slasher Alice, Sweet Alice in the mid-70s, he was shooting a horror parody called Thursday the 12th. And it started production in April 1981, and they were doing it for United Artists. Originally, they were going to go to Paramount. Also had the slasher comedy Student Bodies, which actually came out the same month that Saturday the 14th came out. So according to Cinefantastique, an issue from 1981, New World began shooting Saturday the 14th in June, as we mentioned, 3 weeks in June. So after Thursday the 12th had finished. But because Corman was very used to turning things around very, very quickly, he was already eyeing an August release, which he did. He released it in August in the Midwest. So shooting in June for 3 weeks, releasing in August.
Damn.
That is so fast. Very fast. Even for Corman, very fast. But he was used to turning things around. So the release in the Midwest, Thursday the 12th, was actually looking to open in October of 1981. Because Corman was going to beat them, they pushed it until the spring of next year. And apparently United Artists was not pleased at all. But they did release New World's Galaxy of Terror internationally later that year. So I guess not all love was lost. As for Thursday the 12th, it would eventually come out, as I said, in the spring of 1982 with a different title. Pandemonium is what it ends up being called instead of Thursday the 12th. One of the writers, Richard Whitley, who co-wrote Rock and Roll High School for New World Pictures. Neither did well at the box office, but Saturday the 14th did well on home video. So much so that they did a sequel in 1998 called Saturday the 14th Strikes Back for Corman's Concord Pictures. And what's interesting about it, I don't know if this is any, this might be somewhat conspiratorial, but as I said, I have the 1981 guide for what was coming out in for 1981 in New World Pictures, and they do not list Saturday the 14th.
Oh,
it is not in here. So this probably comes out towards the end of 1980 because they're thinking into 1981, so they don't have, of course, as we mentioned, 1980 and the Christmas, that's when Jeff Begun actually contacts Howard Cohen and says, hey, I got this idea for you. They turn around to Corman, they shoot in June, they release in August, and then in November, they do a wider release in Los Angeles, the same time Student Bodies comes out. So they were not they weren't planning for this. That's how quickly they got into the game, because they said, hey, all these movies are coming out that are making fun of horror films. We better get in on it. But that's it. That is it for Saturday the 14th.
Oh, man.
But we talked about home video, Dead Media. Is it coming to home video, I'm hoping?
Yes. So we're on our roadshow tour right now. We're going to do a leg of that and then take a little time off and then probably do even more roadshow tour. So we'll most likely be coming to a city near lots and lots of folks. It will eventually be on streaming, but there will for sure be a physical media release, Blu-ray for sure, possibly DVD as well. And as soon as I'm done with
gotta
the roadshow,
I'm going to
start working
DVD,
on the bonus
right?
features. Got it. Yes, because yes, it has to be. That's everyone's first question.
Yeah, it has to be on DVD. But yeah, and so you're going to do another roadshow? Is that like in the fall or?
I don't know when this comes out, but as we're recording, we're getting rolling on the roadshow tour. In that, if you want dates on that, you can go to antennareleasing.com/films/deadmedia. And we're going to take a little break and then go back out on the road with more dates to be announced.
Fantastic. So take a look at that. Make sure if you can see Dead Media in a theater, please do that. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend it. We highly recommend it.
Thank you.
I'm excited for the home video release. really excited about that. I was talking with Ryan about it. I was like, boy, I you got to have some pretty cool stuff. I bet plan for that. So I'm very excited for that. Joseph, thank you so much for joining us for this episode. Thank you for watching Saturday the 14th with us and talking about
it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you all.
Congratulations on your movie. We're excited for what you do next. Do you happen to know what you're doing next?
I've got a rough idea. I think I know what I want to do.
Okay.
So, like, artistically, I'm very excited about it. And then I get to the super, super fun thing to think about, raising the money.
Everyone's favorite.
Yeah, maybe I'll make a horror movie about raising money. Yeah.
And you had to raise money for Dead Media, right?
Yeah,
I mean, you had to.
Yeah, and Mark's in Minnesota. I would imagine that you perhaps share some of the cultural baggage that I do. Of like, I don't think any person who has been raised in Minnesota gets up in the morning and goes, I'd like to email a lot of people asking them for money. That sounds like a fun thing to do today. It was real hard.
Yeah.
It was real hard.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But so you did it all. You raised it all privately, I'm assuming, then?
Most of it. And then we had a partnership with a great organization called Film North that did a sort of fiscal sponsorship so I could take straight donations as well as the, you know, equity investment. So, yeah. It was if anybody wants to make films, I really think it's just a matter of you really decide to do it and then you find a way. And that's what's guided me of like, I decided I'm going to do this and I will not be happy with myself if I don't. So makes me pushes me to do unpleasant things like email folks I haven't seen in 5 years going, you have a good job, right? Can I have some money?
Well, still, you and all, you did it. You made the movie. You're touring the movie. Everybody, please go see it. That's such a huge accomplishment. So congratulations. Really,
thank
it's
you
no
so
small
much.
Thing.
Congrats.
So many people think about it, want to make a movie, maybe have that idea, maybe have that screenplay in their desk drawer. But like, you went out there, raised the money, did it.
Did
it's
it.
A huge thing. So amazing. So congrats to you.
Thank you so much.
Hopefully for the next thing, you can come on back. We can talk to you again. If you want to follow Joseph, where can they follow you?
I'm on all the social media at Joseph Scrimshaw, and Dead Media is on Instagram at Dead Media Movie.
Yes, we're following it. So everybody, please follow them there. Look out for Dead Media. Maybe it's screening at a theater near you. Go see it. Thank you so much for being at this episode. We hope you enjoyed it. If you want to listen to all our other episodes, go to our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com. That's where you can find all of our interviews, episodes, t-shirts. Buy a t-shirt. It does help support the show. I'm sure as Joseph can buy a t-shirt also from Dead Media at Antenna Releasing. It is we say it every episode, but it really is kind of big if you can do it.
It is.
If you can, you can manage it. It is a huge thing, actually. So please do that for both of our projects. Or just tell a friend about the show, and we'll see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast, a part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening. To hear more shows from the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network, please select the link in the description